Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name's Tanner, and I'll be one of your hosts today. I'll be joined, as usual, by Taylor. No new patrons to thank this week, but we do have a patron-related announcement. We have recorded and released our first book club episode on Jack London's The Sea Wolf. That first one's out on the main feed, and subsequent episodes will be available for our patrons at the second mate tier. Our second book club selection is A High Wind in Jamaica by Richard Hughes. As with The Sea Wolf, there's plenty of affordable used copies out there, and the book is available in its entirety in digital form online. So check that out if you want to read along with us. And then sometime at the beginning of December, we'll be putting out our second book club episode. So with that, let's bring in Taylor. Taylor, how is it going?
It is going pretty good. Kind of tagging on to your book club stuff. It was a lot of fun to read and discuss The Sea Wolf. I really enjoyed that. I'll be excited to know what people think about that. And I did kind of read a little bit about the background of A High Wind in Jamaica. And yeah, oh my God, it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Yeah. It'll be a lot of fun. So if that's something you're into, definitely check it out. As far as me, I'll combine this with my media check-in, kind of roll through all of it. If you follow us on Instagram, you probably saw a cute little dachshund puppy named Rooney has joined the family. So she kept us pretty busy this weekend, but she's actually really good. We were talking about how she looks just like a wiener dog that we had growing up, who was not as friendly as Rooney. He was a good dog. He was just a little grumpy.
Named Rooney for the Steelers family?
Kind of just a name that Darcy liked, but I quickly seconded it because it worked so well with the Steelers Rooney. Everyone that we tell the name to goes, oh, like Rooney Mara? I'm like, kind of.
Sort of, yeah. There's a connection there.
In a way. And I guess that's a great segue into my actual media check-in, which is somehow the Steelers are winning football games. I don't know. It's weird. Like, it's weird that they're positioning themselves to be in the playoffs. Mike Tomlin will forever be, like, 500 or better. I just don't think it's possible for that man to have a losing record, which isn't great when you're trying to draft and rebuild your team necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it is a rebuilding season for the Packers, but Jordan Love has shown some bright spots. I think he looks good when he looks good.
I don't know how many times in the game this weekend when the Steelers and Packers played, the Steelers would have them in like third and long or even like third and plus long. And then he would just throw something downfield and complete it. Like, he definitely looks like he's got an arm and he's not afraid to see what happens.
It's a fun time to watch the Packers. I mean, they're not winning a ton of games right now, but that'll come. They're winning more games than Aaron Rodgers is right now.
That is true. What about you? What have you been up to?
I guess the most interesting new media thing that we did was Katie and I watched the documentary Life is Waiting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about Western Sahara and their independence fight against Morocco.
Interesting.
I had first heard about it on the It's a Continent podcast. I know I've mentioned them before in media check-ins. That was one of their, I think that episode was from their beginning of season 2, and finally decided to check out the documentary. It's pretty short. It's only like an hour long. It was a wonderful documentary. And I think one of the strengths of it was that it didn't linger as much on the political and military aspects of Western Sahara's history. Mm-hmm. It has kind of settled into sort of a frozen conflict where there's not really active fighting going on right now. Mm-hmm. But that stuff was covered pretty quickly at the beginning. But the overall focus is really on the Sahrawi people and their culture and how they've shepherded and cultivated that culture while being either threatened with or actively under occupation or living in exile communities. A lot of them live in Algeria, and there's a community of them in Spain also, because Spain had been the colonial power there. So you get to hear Sahrawi protest music and see Sahrawi art.
Interesting.
It's it yeah, it's not a group that I really knew a lot about. You know, you see Western Sahara on a map and it's always marked as like disputed territory.
Yeah, I think like the depth of my knowledge is probably like reading a wiki article about it when I saw that on a map sometime, and that's about it.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting cultural blend because, you know, superficially there's a lot of similarities to other North African and Middle Eastern, predominantly Muslim communities, but a lot of the culture is communicated through the medium of the Spanish language. So it's a interesting confluence of stuff that really interests me to hear, you know, those influences culturally and musically and linguistically coming together.
Yeah, and like I guess also one that's probably uniquely accessible to you since Spanish is a language that you're pretty comfortable with.
All right, so we do have a story to get to today. Today was going to be the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, but that's getting postponed because there's a lot of stuff to go over. You know, covering the whole Israel-Palestine conflict in the background section of the notes, not conducive to brevity.
Quickly turning into like a Lions Led by Donkey series.
Right. So instead of that, we're covering a totally different story today. Today's story really starts on January 17th, 1920. Do you know what happened on this day?
Only because I'm looking at the notes.
What happened on this day?
On this day, the 18th Amendment was officially ratified in Congress.
Yeah, that is correct. So if you remember your amendments from school...
None of you know what the 18th Amendment is. Like, you're all looking it up right now.
That one's actually easy to remember because when you're 18, you can't drink. And it's overturned eventually by the 21st Amendment, which is when you can drink.
I could not. Yeah, I guess I've never thought about it that way.
But anyway, yes, cat's out of the bag. 18th Amendment is ratified in Congress on January 16th, 1919, when the amendment is ratified by 36 out of 48 states. That is 75%, and that's one of the ways you can pass a constitutional amendment. Section 1 of the 18th Amendment reads...
After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within the importation thereof into or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territories subject to its jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited. It's a stupid way of writing a stupid law.
When we look at amendments in class, because we talk about those when we talk about like the civics unit, one of the things we do is we look at these old amendments and we basically translate them into modern English or more modern English. So they get easier as you get more modern, obviously, but some of the early ones like the Bill of Rights are actually really challenging for them.
and that's why we still debate them and look at them like they're chicken bones.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the points I make is that, like, yeah, I mean, a lot of Americans would read this and like not totally agree on what it means.
It's always great when your nation's laws are set by like prophecy.
And actually, interesting, I didn't know this. Two states actually never did ratify the 18th Amendment.
I did not know that either.
That's Connecticut and Rhode Island.
Not the two I would have picked either.
So yeah, how that works basically is if 75% of the states ratify it in their state legislature, it becomes the law for everyone.
Interesting. Like, was there any, I wonder if there was any sort of like, you know, like the medical marijuana movement kind of operates in a weird gray area. Like, I wonder if there was any of that in states that didn't sign it, if they like found ways around it or something. Like,
there are some loopholes that we'll get to. So to aid in the enforcement of this new law, Congress passed the National Prohibition Act, better known to history as the Volstead Act, after the man who introduced it to the House of Representatives, Republican Andrew Volstead of Minnesota, the 7th District, if I remember correctly.
Just want to say, like, imagine this being your legacy. Like, just an absolute failure of a law. Congratulations, Mr. Volstead. Your family's probably ashamed of you.
He actually wasn't even in Congress much longer after. I think he only was in Congress for like one more cycle after that was passed, and then he was done.
This is already igniting like libertarian like passions within me.
That's not something you want to unleash.
for legal reasons, I'm talking about laws.
You mentioned the name association. Despite Volstead being the name associated with this law, he had relatively little to do with the actual content of it. He was just a guy who would put his name on it to sponsor it and, you know, get it on the floor. It's largely the ideological work of Wayne Wheeler, the head of the Anti-Saloon League. He just looks like a very disagreeable person, Wayne Wheeler.
It's kind of weird because I almost feel like this view or this bit of politics here, like, just totally doesn't have a place in our current demographic because the right is too libertarian focused and the left is just not going to be against some, or, you know, not going to be for something like this. So it's just weird that something like this would even have any popular support anywhere.
Well, it's interesting how the temperance movement and then eventually the prohibition movement and the women's suffrage movement built off of each other and really empowered each other. There's a reason that the 18th and 19th Amendments passed when they did, so close to each other, with, you know, the 19th giving women the right to vote in the United States. And yeah, it was because, you know, the Anti-Saloon League, Wayne Wheeler, he supported women's suffrage because he felt that if women got the vote, they would help to pass temperance laws. So where are we here? One of the things the Volstead Act did, it defined an intoxicating liquor as any beverage containing more than 0.5% alcohol. It did allow exceptions for industrial uses of alcohol, as well as exemptions for medical and religious use of alcohol, with the proper permits.
Interesting.
If you need Old Crow for your religious ceremony, depending on what church you're going to. Prohibition also didn't make the act of consuming alcohol illegal. So any alcohol that you purchased before the law took effect was legal for home consumption. And yeah, like as the law that you read stated, you had a year to prep for this. So, you know, if you had a big cellar you wanted to fill with alcohol, it was totally legal to consume it after this passed. Producing alcohol at home was another option for many Americans, although obviously you couldn't legally sell it to others.
I think it's just so funny because it's so typical that we've passed a law that inconveniences everyone, but doesn't out and out make something illegal. It just makes you work harder to get it. And there's really no benefit for anyone at that point.
And sort of as you see with like drug criminalization laws is that, you know, very often if you make something illegal or you criminalize the treatment for it, all it does is force people into other, even less safe avenues. Mm-hmm. Of accomplishing the same goal. And that was one of the criticisms of prohibition is that, well, you know, if people can't buy whiskey that's been, you know, made in an actual distillery, they're going to make some shit in their backyard that's going to kill them. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like or that's going to kill them faster.
Like things that actually happened.
You know, they're going to be drinking, you know, boot polish and stuff like that.
That was just the Russian army, I think, at one point.
So our story today concerns the importation part of the 18th Amendment. In other words, rum running.
More than just a drink at Jimmy Buffett's.
So despite the... Oh, rest in peace. Despite the superficially strict sounding ban on alcohol commerce, the actual enforcement of the law was a persistent challenge for the 13-ish years that prohibition lasted.
Imagine that. We've passed the law and have no way to enforce it.
I mean, that is really the enduring legacy of prohibition is how little it was enforced.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, from like TV shows and movies and stuff, you associate, you know, like, you know, gangsters and stuff with getting alcohol. But it's like, you know, the average person who wanted to drink during prohibition wouldn't have had a hard time getting one.
Yeah, I feel like it's actually painted like a lot harder to get in movies to build that tension than it would have been for like. Not for like a rum runner or a bootlegger, but yeah, like it's like the average guy who's just a factory worker, he's going to be able to find some booze somewhere.
It was very available.
Like sometimes they make it look like going to like a speakeasy is like a scene from Inglourious Basterds where you're trying to outsmart the SS. And I don't think it was actually like that.
City by city also, it was either St. Louis or Kansas City was one of those places refused to work with federal agents who would be the ones enforcing prohibition laws. It was like a sanctuary city for alcohol.
Yeah, I would imagine that like a lot of your places, like a Cincinnati, a Milwaukee, Chicago, obviously those places, Chicago, like they, you could drink in those cities.
So quoting here from Nancy Gailey Skoglund, who is one of her articles is the main source for this episode.
The impossibility of policing American borders without assistance became bitterly clear to United States officials, who in the early 1920s pressed neighboring countries and Britain into treaties inhibiting the exportation of liquor from their territories. In 1924, Canada agreed to exchange clearance information on suspected smugglers and to prevent the clearances of vessels for ports where their cargo was already known to be contraband.
So basically enlisting Canadian help to say, like, hey, if you know for a fact that this ship is full of Canadian Club whiskey and it's headed for New York, could you please not let them leave, buddy?
Like, I guess what's Canada's incentive to do that? Like, are we going to try to invade for a third time and take Quebec?
I guess. And, I think what's interesting here is that you see some parallels with another controversial law that was passed in the United States that we ended up needing help from Britain and Canada to actually enforce. The fugitive slave laws. We talked about that in the Saltwater Railroad bonus episode, where the U.S. would ask for, but not always get support in the return of escaped slaves who had made it to, British territory in the Caribbean. And Britain basically, would kind of say, unless they committed something that we also consider a crime, tough shit. That's your problem. But yeah, playing a little bit nicer here. An additional treaty from 1924 did give British and Canadian vessels the right to transport sealed liquor into U.S. waters on board passenger ships.
Can you even imagine that nowadays? I guess, like, all right, everyone put the booze away.
Kind of like going to a football game. They'll let you in if your water bottle is still sealed. One of the articles I read pointed out that, like, that treaty didn't benefit Canada at all because, like, they didn't own any passenger liners at this point that were, like, theirs, I guess.
Interesting.
The U.S. Coast Guard was in turn given the authority to board and search vessels suspected of bootlegging, provided that there was a reasonable suspicion.
I will say the Coast Guard is generally the hero of our stories. Today we get to see the other thing they do.
The Coast Guard, one of those borderline ACAB cases of when they're rescuing people, no, when they're interdicting alcohol, yes.
It's a reminder that technically they are a military and law enforcement organization.
Well, I guess at this point, they're not quite military yet.
They have guns.
They do.
Like, they're armed. I guess I don't want to make it sound like they're a militia, but I guess you would call them paramilitary.
Armed agents of the U.S. Treasury at this point, I guess. When did they actually become military?
I know
we've looked this up before.
All the Coast Guard people are probably yelling at us right now. It's hard too because they claim, of course, like the most ancient date possible.
Is it a World War II thing?
It might be a World War II thing. It was formed with a merger of the U.S. Revenue Cutter Service and the Life Saving Service in 1915. In 1939, the Lighthouse Service was merged. I don't know. There's not an easy answer that I'm seeing.
Are there armed lighthouse agents?
Is it Robert Evans that always talks about, like, or no, it's Alice Caldwell Kelly that always talks about liking the weird police people, like the postal service police.
Anyway, at this point, we're still dealing with the Department of the Treasury. I guess rather than being part of the military, what we're looking for is when did they become, is it the Department of Defense they would be part of now?
Mm-hmm. Coast Guard was moved to the Department of Transportation in 1967. And then in 2003, it was part of the Department of Homeland Security.
Oh.
However, under such and such act, the Coast Guard and Marine Transportation Act of 2006, Congress, the Coast Guard operates as a service in the Navy, Department. I don't know. It's all over the place. It's weird. The Coast Guard exists in a really weird place.
They're part of the Department of Education because they are educating America's enemies about what happens when you commit crimes.
Point being, they have guns and they can and will arrest you.
So, where are we here? So, they have this authority to board vessels suspected of bootlegging. An element of this authority that will play very heavily into our story is the limit on where suspected bootleggers could be boarded. Boarding and search had to be conducted within a distance from shore that the vessel in question could conceivably cover in 1 hour.
I love a good non-specific red line.
Naturally, that distance depends on the vessel. So there's a built-in inherent gray area in this definition. This is also a different restriction from the 12-mile limit in place for the purpose of domestic revenue law. And also, as we'll see, different from the 3-mile limit that is kind of the internationally accepted territorial waters limit. So to attempt the enforcement of these laws was the U.S. Coast Guard. At this time, about 12,000 strong with 500 vessels and 300 stations on shore. So with essentially any vessel within 1 hour of shore being fair game for the Coast Guard, it behooved the gangsters and bootleggers to invest in fast ships that could cover that distance in as little time as possible. One such vessel was today's main character, the schooner-rigged fishing vessel I'm Alone.
This is by far the creepiest named vessel we've ever talked about.
It's also the hardest to write about and post about.
I believe it.
So she was registered in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, and operated largely in New England through the mid-1920s. She boasted two 100-horsepower engines, but that wasn't really her biggest asset when it came to avoiding the Coast Guard. Her secret weapon was actually her radio.
Yeah, that's a pretty big advantage at this point, I would imagine.
Yeah, this is a time when not all vessels would have had one, especially not, you know, smaller fishing vessels.
Mm-hmm.
This allowed her to listen in on the Coast Guard, you know, some of those conversations being directly concerned with her.
I've just had a great idea. And it's a Smokey and the Bandit style movie.
but
like inspired by this story. TM trademark.
Smokey and the Bandit, Boardwalk Empire. Crossover. So yeah, being able to listen in on the Coast Guard allowed her to avoid being intercepted and boarded. Her elusiveness earned her the label of Bismarck of the Rum Fleet. And her reputation's also possibly going to play a role in the legal case we get into later. The I'm Alone spent a lot of time in the ports of Yarmouth and Halifax in Nova Scotia, often with a listed destination of St. Pierre and Miquelon, off the south coast of Newfoundland. So the important thing for the purpose of bootlegging is that St. Pierre and Miquelon, despite their location, are French territory.
I actually have randomly like read about this place before, and it is really funny because like the French take it super seriously.
Well, I mean, it's like all they've got left of the old North American French holdings. I think I first learned about them from Fred Anderson's The Crucible of War, about the Seven Years' War. So, while the U.S. could very easily get information on a vessel's destination sailing from a Canadian port due to those treaties with Britain, there's no similar agreement with France.
I feel like France has even less incentive to like play along with this, too.
So once they hit St. Pierre and Miquelon, they can kind of disappear for a little bit for the purposes of the United States. So by the end of 1928, her owners had decided to move her to the Caribbean, possibly to take advantage of the winter tourism industry. It appears that during this time, rather than smuggling liquor into American ports, she'd meet up with other vessels at sea off the American coast to exchange the cargo, basically acting as like a mothership for the, I think they called them mosquito boats. To come out and get the actual alcohol and bring it back. They had a cool system where they would use like a torn in half dollar bill that each party would have. And so when they would meet up, make sure that the bill fit back together.
Interesting. It's like a old school, like challenge coin situation or something.
Yeah. And it was in this capacity as a Caribbean rum runner that we come to the time of today's incidents. The date is March 20th, 1929. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Walcott, commanded by Captain Frank Paul, is stationed near the Trinity Shoals light buoy off the coast of Louisiana. So just from a quick Google Maps look, this looks to be almost equidistant between New Orleans and Houston. So at 6:30 a.m., the Walcott spotted the rum-running Bismarck, the U.S. Coast Guard's white whale, the I'm Alone. Now, Walcott would not have known this specifically But I'm Alone was loaded with 3,000 cases of liquor worth about $62,000.
The classic, I know you're guilty, but I can't prove it right now.
I know you've got something on there, but I don't know what just yet. And if you could please just slow down and let me board, I will check it out. The Walcott approached the I'm Alone and ordered the suspected smuggler to heave to. Now, being at least 14 miles offshore, Captain John Randall replied,
Captain, you have no jurisdiction over me. I am on the high seas outside of treaty waters. I cannot and will not heave to.
Also, the captain of the I'm Alone, it might be pronounced Randell, but Randall just sounds more natural. The Walcott radioed to the nearest Coast Guard shore station with the following message. And then throughout these messages, you'll see the term black used. That's just referring to a smuggling vessel that they're discussing.
I'm Alone, found 10 miles from the shoreline. Request two patrol boats or a cutter to help board same. Fired on black, but refuses to stop. They threaten to shoot to kill if boarded.
The name of this ship, the I'm Alone, it leads to some good potential, like Abbott and Costello riffing.
It does, doesn't it?
And what's the name of that vessel? I'm Alone, sir. Well, I know, but just give me the name of that vessel and we'll get right on it.
It would have been hilarious in like 1920s cinema.
So amidst the continued demands from the Walcott via megaphone and signal flag, Paul and a warrant officer from the Walcott actually were able to go on board I'm Alone to attempt negotiations. This is like old school, like Age of Sail type stuff, you know, rowing over to the other boat.
Yeah, there is like a pirate quality to this.
So these were unsuccessful, and the chase was resumed.
I think it's funny. Like, do you think they let the captain and the warrant officer like row back before they started again, or do they just like see ya?
Yeah. One source does claim that Randall offered Captain Paul a drink while he was on board.
I hope so.
Which was declined. I hope that detail's true. It seems a little bit too movie-ish, but. So according to Captain Randall's account of what happened next, around 2 p.m., the Walcott approached again, signaling, heave to or I fire. Quoting here from Randall, I replied to him by megaphone that I had no intention of stopping and that he could fire if he wished. The Walcott granted another 15 minutes for I'm Alone to make a final decision. And then Randall's account continues.
We still kept going on. And a few moments after the time expired, the Walcott commenced firing. I do not know the number of shots. Several shots passed through our sails and rigging, and one shell passed through the flag, which was flying from the time the cutter came up at first. After firing his four-pounder, a certain number of shots, he opened fire from his quarter ports with a machine gun or quick-firing rifle. I presume these bullets had been waxed, as one hit me on the right leg just below the hip and partially paralyzed it. I then noticed that he had some trouble with his 4-pound as she misfired. He then dropped astern.
In that quote, he mentions the bullets being waxed, which is not something I was really familiar with, but I guess wax rounds are
old school, less than lethal.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like lethal optional, I guess you could call them.
Not maybe shooting intentionally to kill here. So the Walcott messaged back to the Coast Guard station at 3 p.m. that she had shot away part of the smuggler's rigging, but that the vessel refused to surrender. With the gun jammed, she'd continued to trail I'm Alone until advised otherwise. The station replied,
under no conditions allow Black to escape. Seas and tow to New Orleans.
So complying with her orders, the Walcott continued to pursue I'm Alone through the evening of March 20th and through the following day. The Treasury Department had now ordered the Walcott to seize the vessel if the commander was certain the original point of the hailing had occurred within 12 miles of shore.
This guy got himself in the classic, I thought this was going to be easy and over quickly, and now I'm not really sure, but I have to say yes.
You've got to dig in at this point.
Like, yeah, he doesn't have, he can't be like, well, I think I was. He's got to commit at this point.
The cutter wired the following back in response.
"Will not allow Black to escape. Will try again to seize her when weather improves. Have shot through sails, also British flag. Master appears desperate. Have not enough men to board her. Will take long chance if other boats do not arrive tomorrow."
That's interesting, like big words, but it's like, are you going to get your guys killed to board a rum runner that you know you're probably going to see again?
Yeah, like this does feel like it's just continued escalation for no reason at a certain point. But also like a little projection with Master appears desperate. Like, I feel like, who's desperate?
Yeah, because like he's done this before. Well, and actually what's funny is that like he's done this before with the Walcott. Like these vessels know each other.
So this is like Smokey and the Bandit.
Very much. Like they're very familiar with each other. And the Dexter that we'll see here in a minute. Also, like these vessels know each other. The captains know each other. The I'm Alone has been caught before doing this. I don't know the ins and outs of, you know, how you get away with that and go back to it. But again, being a Canadian vessel, obviously she's probably not just getting seized by the Coast Guard.
Do they stop for Diablo sandwiches like in Smokey and the Bandit?
So despite her stated willingness to do so, the Walcott would not be forced to take her long chance, thanks to the arrival of some backup in the form of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Dexter, which arrived on scene around 7:30 a.m. on March 22nd.
I just realized that the Walcott basically like tried to make themselves look like they were going to have to do something desperate to get more help. Like they almost had to like play victim back to the Coast Guard. Like it's weird.
Yeah, I think he's basically saying, like, well, if you want me to get these guys killed, that's fine. I'm happy to do my job, but...
Mm-hmm.
Also, I do want to point out, Coast Guard cutter, obviously, like, what type of ship that entails has kind of changed over the years. These are really small. Like, I think they have crews of about 15, and they have, like, literally a single gun on.
Yeah, it's not like the, like, destroyer-esque vessels and stuff that you see now that are... And like the endurance cutters and stuff like that.
So Dexter had left Pascagoula without two of her crew because she was, you know, so eager to get involved in this chase. So she's probably even less than 15.
I will say that if a vessel was named Dexter, Cutter is a good name for the vessel.
This is true. Stabber.
The U.S. Coast Guard's Stabber.
The Rappin' Plastic Wrapper class. Let's see. The Dexter signaled to the I'm Alone with a similar message to what the Walcott had sent. Heave to or be fired on. Interesting switching to the passive voice there, saying, this is not me who's doing this. This is you. You have done this. So quoting again from Randall.
"I replied by semaphore and megaphone that I did not consider that he had any jurisdiction over me or my ship on the high seas, and that he could fire if he wished. He then commenced to fire shell after shell, first to my rigging and sails, and then opened fire from the bridge with several quick-firing rifles. After about 20 shells had been fired, several of which hit the ship in various places, I semaphored him that he might fire and sink my ship, but I refused to heave to."
There is a little bit of the what are you going to do, stab me meme.
That's exactly what I was thinking as I was reading that. Like, what are you going to do, shoot me?
The juxtaposition of he could fire if he wished. He then commenced to fire. still refusing to heave to, I'm Alone sustained an estimated 60 to 70 hits from the Dexter. The ship's engineer reported to Randall that the engine room was flooding, and Randall gave orders to stop engines and ready the dories to abandon ship. And I think we mentioned this already, but one of the reasons that will be stated later for why boarding wasn't attempted is the state of the sea conditions is that it's pretty rough. Mm-hmm. So abandoning ship in this weather is kind of known to be like this is not really going to be a successful evacuation, especially under fire. But still trying to get off the ship safely. I don't know if they ran lifeboat drills on these rum runners.
Probably didn't conform to OSHA regulations. That's who they were really afraid of, is the ocean inspector.
Soon the bow began to dip into the water. When Randall abandoned ship, he estimated that the bow was about 20 feet underwater and the stern was about 10 feet in the air. The Walcott would summarize the action in a cable, saying, "Black sunk. Total persons number 8 and 1 corpse."
But like, that's like the weirdest word he could have picked for the end. You could have picked other things and conveyed that message.
Could you have said this weirder?
This guy must be like the Dwight Schrute of like the Coast Guard at the time. And like the people back at the corporate are just like, "God, this guy's weird."
5 of the bootlegging crew were picked up by the Dexter and 3 by the Walcott. With regard to that one corpse, Seaman First Class Charles Rayburn of the Dexter personally jumped into the water to rescue one of the I'm Alone's crew who was floating face down in, you know, as we said, these choppy seas. This was the ship's bosun and a French citizen, Leon Mongi, I think is how this is pronounced, but he is main guy to us.
Leon main guy.
He's the main guy, although he clearly isn't because he's dead now. So
also, I want to say, like, the Coast Guard is like one of the only organizations that will actually sink your boat and then risk their lives to save you from the water. I feel like if that was the Navy, they'd be like, "Here's a life ring. Good luck."
Yeah, I think three of the Coast Guard actually ended up being in the water rescuing people, even before the days when they had fancy helicopters and stuff.
And Ashton Kutcher.
I mean, it literally is as we've alluded to already, is like there's the bright side and the dark side of the Coast Guard. And this is kind of it in microcosm. So quoting here from Skoglund.
"Halfway between Louisiana and the Yucatan Peninsula, in nearly 2,000 fathoms of water, the Union Jack had gone down, riddled with bullet holes from American guns. And an international incident was in the making."
So that's the other thing. The pursuit starts super close to shore, you know, somewhere around 10 to 15 miles from shore, and it goes really, really far away from shore. And that is the basis of why this becomes an international incident, is because you've got the U.S. Coast Guard sinking a foreign vessel in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico.
And killing a French national. Like, you're angering multiple countries here.
Yeah, you're bringing in Britain and Canada and France now. Classic international incident.
To be clear, we would have probably also just been fine bringing Mexico into if we had made it further. Like, if the I'm Alone had continued going the way she was going and getting towards Mexico, like, I'm sure that wouldn't have stopped us.
You want some too? We'll actually talk about Pancho Villa in a few minutes here. So 5 days after the sinking of I'm Alone, Canadian Ambassador Vincent Massey arrived at the U.S. State Department to begin his inquiry into the sequence of events that led to the sinking of a ship and the death of one of her crew. The biggest point of contention in the case would be the legality of the pursuit and the appropriate use of force by the Coast Guard cutter, Dexter.
Interesting. Things to debate.
So from a legal standpoint, it was largely about where the original point of hailing had been that kind of constituted the beginning of the chase. So with varying estimates, the Coast Guard asserted that it had been between 8.6 and 10.6 miles from shore when this first hail occurred. Randall claimed with equal confidence that he had been no closer than 14 and a half miles and had been outside the treaty limit.
I feel like at the time, this is like an unprovable fact. Like, without GPS,
there's absolutely
data,
no way to prove this.
This is 100% like he said, she said.
The U.S. Coast Guard also cited the particular speed of the I'm Alone as a reason for extending the limits of their authority to points further out to sea. This brings in that gray area.
This is why you can't have arbitrary limits to serious things.
You can't have time be the cutoff to this. Yeah, like that's baked into any of these regulations and these laws is the fact that this is an estimate, you know, of how fast this is going
to
get.
That's why when a lot of states where police were trying to hand out tickets for saying, "Well, it looked like you were speeding," like, it's like, no, that's not how this works.
Skoglund has this to say about the questionable value of U.S. Coast Guard assertions.
"On the surface, there would seem to have been little comparison between the word of a confessed rum skipper and that of a U.S. Coast Guard officer. But there was one case, and proponents of the Canadian view cited it often. in which a Coast Guard officer, Sigrid Johnson, had lied about the position at which he had seized the Coal Harbor, been court-martialed, and later sentenced for perjury.
Yeah, so Coast Guard showing how, like, you know, you impugn your own integrity one time, and that puts a black mark on your entire organization. Now everyone's going to be talking about that.
This works really well, though, for both sides in a way, because all of the Canadian-aligned people are going to be like, look, they've done it before. But then the Coast Guard could be like, no, no, when someone messes up, we take care of it and handle it.
It reminds me of that joke that I forget how I first heard it, but it's like the guy's like, you know, life's not fair. I built that bridge and no one calls me Andrew the Bridge Builder. You know, I cleared that forest. No one calls me Andrew the Forest Clearer. But you fuck one sheep. So the Coast Guard's honor is, you know, in question here because of these previous circumstances. And this highlights the bit of a quandary that Canada was in from a legal standpoint. They obviously don't want to be seen as valuing the word of this rum runner over a law enforcement authority of an allied nation. So basically, they tried to keep the focus on just the inherent affront of sinking any vessel flying their flag, regardless of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Think, hey, you can't do that.
Can you imagine, like, naval warfare at this time period, like on the Great Lakes? The year is 1929. Lake Erie is a battlefield.
Two cutters with, like, one single 3-inch gun apiece, just, like, bing, at each other. Canadian suicide Kaiten human torpedoes tearing up the harbor front in, like, Detroit.
Sandusky was never the same after the Great Battle of 1930.
So actually, also in Randall's favor was his honorable service during the Great War, where he earned a Distinguished Service Medal and the Croix de Guerre.
Huh, interesting. Those come from the same countries that the U.S. kind of pissed off.
And I don't, because in the source it says Distinguished Service Medal. I couldn't find something specifically called that. So I don't know if this is supposed to be the Distinguished Service Order or the Distinguished Conduct Medal. But
interesting.
I'm assuming one of those two things. And then, of course, the Croix de Guerre from the French. If you've earned those, you've fought, you know, in the trenches over in France, probably the idea of a Coast Guard cutter doesn't really scare you that much.
Yeah, I would think that you're pretty comfortable doing what you're doing. Probably also whoever's liquor that actually is scares you a lot more.
Probably, yeah. Another factor in the legality of the chase was the internationally accepted principle of hot pursuit.
I did not realize this was a technical term.
I did not either, so yeah, I was excited to learn about this.
In an effort to permit nations to protect their coastlines, this doctrine permitted a vessel of the threatened nation to pursue, overhaul, and seize an offending vessel in international waters, provided that the chase began within the 3-mile limit, that the pursuit was uninterrupted, and that the pursuing vessel kept the fleeing vessel constantly in sight. The third condition fulfilled the qualification of hot pursuit.
So a small hang-up here for the Coast Guard, though.
Did they hit any of those things?
So the answer's kind of on all of them. So it's not a great case for them.
I think if you have three kind ofs, that's a fail. Like, you want one or two. You want one really good one.
So by strict application of the rule, the pursuit of I'm Alone could be in question on the grounds that while the Walcott had pursued her from inside treaty waters, according to the Coast Guard, it was the Dexter who had taken over the chase and fired the shells that sank her. So only the Walcott had continuously pursued her.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't count. This is cheating. You can't get help like this.
Right, because, like, you're losing your visual. Like, the first person is losing visual.
They mentioned 3 miles. That's, like, the generally accepted area where a nation wielded legal authority. But the U.S. Domestic Tariff Act of 1922 extended that out to 12 miles for certain purposes.
Would that even, I wonder, like, if that went to, like, an international court, though, would that even hold up?
Well, and that's actually the problem here, is that you have different elements of the U.S. government arguing different things based on what is most relevant to their expertise.
Interests.
Mm. Because, yeah, that was something used for domestic purposes. And for something like this, under international law, it's not really going to hold up. So U.S. Attorney General William Mitchell argued that hot pursuit limits should be extended to match the limit of 1 hour's sail. Things get really dodgy here with the legal side of it, because using different precedents to argue for different things that they didn't originally apply to. So
And back to this 1 hour sail thing of like an arbitrary limit.
So the other thing here is the appropriate use of force by the Dexter. So all other things aside, even if it was ruled that this was a legal pursuit, they and the U.S. Coast Guard was within their rights to do this, the use of force is another aspect of this.
Yeah, it's like okay, so you have maybe explanations for all the first bit there, but like, yeah, there's still this whole other like application of deadly force aspect.
You killed a guy, a French guy, yeah. But still a guy.
The main guy.
Yeah, you killed the main guy. What are we going to do about this? Standard practice would have been to chase down and board the vessel. But as we've seen, I'm Alone's speed took that really off the table. That was obviously much easier to talk about than to actually execute. A.W. Powell, master of the Dexter, likely was also wary of Captain Randall's clearly stated intention to fire upon any Coast Guard personnel attempting to board his ship. He told me he was going to shoot, so I did it first.
If it was me, I probably just wouldn't board that ship.
Powell had served in the First World War, and I believe I saw that he had served on submarine chasers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how developed that was in the First World War, but I assume we had something for it. He kind of has, I guess, the mentality to not shy away from this type of thing and to hunt this vessel down.
To hunt this Red October?
So the State Department position was that if Captain Randall knew that his ship was being illegally stopped and searched, he should have gone along peacefully and contested the actions in court.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard that. Yep. We've heard that many times before.
And strangely enough, it kind of ends up the same way, usually.
If you have nothing to hide, you have no reason to resist, right? So on the other hand, Skoglund writes,
condemning the Coast Guard's action were the considerations that the amount of force used was incommensurate with the offense which would have been charged, and that in this case, the advantages of enforcing U.S. revenue laws were outweighed by the potential loss of international goodwill.
Oh, yeah. So the issue here of saying, you know, even if this vessel had been successfully taken in, the things they would have been charged with versus if they had gotten away, saying, is it really worth the use of deadly force? I mean, this is like when the police shoot someone who's suspected of shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever fine or misdemeanor they're going to get charged with, is it worth taking their life over?
You know, you're kind of joking about calling this the white whale, but in a way it kind of is to the Coast Guard. What are they willing, in this guy's case, it's like, what's he willing to sacrifice to get it done? And in this case, it's an international incident, apparently.
I'm sure this contributes to it somewhat, but you know, like we said at the beginning, how hard it was to actually enforce prohibition. You know, on the off chance that you were a legitimate law enforcement person who wanted to do your job, you didn't really have a ton of opportunities to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, this is a very porous system. Having to deal with just the rife, rampant corruption, open corruption in many cases of law enforcement during Prohibition. So, yeah, I mean, if you were actually trying to do your job, you probably had a rare few chances to do it. So in this case, he's got his white whale. He wants to get it for sure.
Also, I'm imagining he's not like super high ranking if he's, you know, just out here on one of these small vessels. There's probably some really pissed off, like, State Department people and ambassadors that are getting woken up and having to work extra, being like, who's this guy that did this? Like, I just want to talk to him.
So on April 9th, 1929, this is about 2.5 weeks after the sinking of I'm Alone, Ambassador Massey, I like that name, I like the assonance of his name and title, Ambassador Massey, presented Canada's formal note of protest to U.S. Secretary of State Henry Stimson. I imagine Henry Stimson as an English bulldog. Stimson, come now. There were three main points to the note. One, I'm Alone had been originally hailed by the Walcott outside the 1 hour sailing distance. Like you said, there's zero way of knowing this. Neither side has any way of verifying this. Point number two, hot pursuit was inapplicable since the pursuit had not been continuous and it began outside of U.S. territorial waters. And three, the destruction of the I'm Alone and the loss of life were unwarranted.
I feel like even if you want to toss out number one as unknowable, like the other two are solid enough.
So in addition to these 3 points included in the formal note, Massey added additional informal complaints during his interview with Stimson, which was recorded in Stimson's notes on the meeting. So these included that the crew had been placed in irons after being taken aboard the Coast Guard vessels. Captain Randall had not been immediately informed of the death of his crewmen. The British flag had been fired upon and mutilated. The source said British. I don't know if it was flying the British flag rather than a Canadian one. I know the Canadian flag had the Union Jack on it at this time. So maybe that's what it means. Rifle fire had been used. I'm not totally sure why that alone warranted complaint, but my best guess is that that could have only been like an anti-personnel thing rather than trying to cripple the ship.
Yeah, I would imagine that you lose any bit of cover that you've had of like, oh, I'm just trying to disable the vessel.
Yeah, it's like that clearly is you're trying to kill people. And Captain Randall was not immediately taken to the British consul in New Orleans.
So like in theory, they kidnapped a British citizen, threw him in chains, and then just didn't let him contact like the British government.
And they sank any evidence that he was doing something illegal.
Yeah, other than them saying that they were there in the wrong place, like, that's it.
Yeah. So throughout this story, you have an interesting divide in loyalties within the U.S. government. The State Department, under Kellogg and then under Stimson, they have an eye towards diplomacy. You know, that's literally their job. They're far more accommodating of the Canadian point of view, and they're much more demanding of evidence from the Coast Guard.
Because they're like the ones that actually have to pick up the phone and talk to other countries.
It's like their problem to deal with, so they have to be a bit more open to negotiation. On the other hand, we've got Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon.
I did a deep dive on him today, actually.
And what'd you find in there?
Well, he was a Treasury Secretary under Herbert Hoover, so like that, I don't know what else we need to know about him other than know that probably wasn't very good at his job.
And he's got a university named after him.
Uh-huh.
Was it Andrew Carnegie?
Yeah. Carnegie, yeah, Mellon. Both of them. Yeah, so good banker, horrible Treasury Secretary? I don't know.
So yeah, Mellon.
I guess I want to be clear for anyone that doesn't know American politics that well. This is the Treasury Secretary that like sets up the
Great Depression.
The Great Depression in the U.S., if you don't know who Herbert Hoover is. So now, Andrew Mellon kind of sucks.
So he, as you said, the Coast Guard is a Treasury thing here. He's got the Coast Guard's back the whole way.
Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, Mellon is behind the Coast Guard the whole way. He just takes their word for everything and doesn't really want to hear anything to the contrary. Additionally, he argued that the Coast Guard had acted in the right because the I'm Alone had defied the authority of the United States.
The old because I said so thing with the kids.
Which is like not a super tight legal argument.
Because I really want it to be this way.
Attorney General Mitchell, he stuck to the line of arguing for the 1 hour hot pursuit limit rather than the 3 mile limit.
I feel like that's honestly their best argument. Is to try to get it into like a subjective space.
It is. And like everyone, you know, you've got Mellon and the Coast Guard using very like emotionally charged language. Well, they defied our authority. And then you've got like the State Department trying to be nice about it. And then you've got the Attorney General trying to like funnel it towards something he can actually work with from a legal standpoint. The whole story on the U.S. side is really, you know, the Coast Guard saying they did nothing wrong, and then the State Department, which is woke and gay, having to more realistically accept the diplomatic intricacies of the situation, you know, compared to our brave patriot boys in the Coast Guard. So in the formal response to the specifics of the Canadian protest note, the U.S. argued, with the speed of I'm Alone, she was clearly within the 1 hour sailing distance. Again, harping on that. The fact that Randall had chosen to flee showed that he knew this.
Ah.
If he were outside treaty waters, why would he run?
Because they certainly wouldn't look at all this liquor and be like, huh, that's still going to be a problem, I suppose, since we're here. And no one's going to know the difference.
The arrest would have been valid when he was first hailed, but the search was only made impossible through illegal actions of the pursued vessel when being ordered to heave to.
Ah, that's a good like legalese like response right there.
You committed a crime and you made us commit a crime.
Mm.
That's like a double crime on you.
That's like when there's like a high speed pursuit and a deputy plows into a minivan and then they like charge the person who is fleeing with more stuff. Where like I get the thought process, but also like maybe high speed pursuits are bad. Like maybe don't do it.
This is like when you drop 20,000 pounds of bombs on a hospital and you say, well, the bad guys were here and we had to do this and we didn't want to do this, but you made us.
History is evergreen with examples.
They mentioned the chase not being continuous, but what if the Coast Guard said, nuh-uh, yeah, it is, because Walcott and Dexter belong to the same unit.
Ah, it's like a tag in wrestling. Like, all right, you're the legal man.
And they are very similar. I think they might be literally carbon copy ships of one another. So really, who's to say that one ship is a different discrete entity than another?
You just see like the Dexter with like a line through it and just like Walcott like sloppily written on the side of it.
Also, boarding was impossible and there's no way to disable I'm alone that didn't also endanger the crew. Massey had suggested that Massey was the Canadian ambassador. He had floated the idea of, well, why couldn't you shoot at the rudder and disable the vessel? Which I think does seem like a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic, like, why don't they just shoot him in the leg? It's like, that's just not how it works when you're shooting someone.
It's not a great solution. You probably just shouldn't be shooting someone. Treasury Secretary Mellon was able to respond well enough to Massey's informal additions to the protest that Massey really didn't press those. So Canada rejected the U.S. response on the basis that the one-hour distance, and thus the originating location of the chase, had not been proven, and the entire argument rested on both of those factors. The Canadians were also not fully convinced of the necessity of force in apprehending the I'm Alone.
Could not the pursuit have been continued, as the Walcott skipper allegedly urged the Dexter captain? The impression conveyed to observers was that the Coast Guardsman had essayed not to halt the I'm Alone, but to punish her.
Yeah, it wouldn't be hard to believe that, given the history and the reputation of the vessel, in addition to the open defiance of her captain.
I mean, I'm sure that, yeah, like, I mean, this is probably unknown, this is a known vessel to them. Like, there's no doubt they want to get it. And, like, this guy probably thinks he's doing the right thing until, like, it all happens, and then suddenly everyone's looking at him like, huh, you've taken this a little too far.
Maybe he sees himself as a Christ figure of saying, like, this needs to be done and I will take the blame for it. The Scoglin article does get into the depths of the FBI's hunt for the smuggling ring related to I'm Alone, but it's too much to cover here. It's really interesting, but it's not all really maritime related. Instead, we'll skip ahead to the beginning of the arbitration tribunal on January 28th, 1932. The major finding of this tribunal was that because the schooner I'm Alone had been intentionally sunk, the sinking was unwarranted. So from the very beginning of this, they're not able to plead that this was an accidental sinking. They're very clear about the fact that they are shooting at this vessel to disable and possibly sink it. The final tribunal session didn't begin until December 28th, 1934. Can you think of anything that has changed in the country between 1932 and 1934?
I do believe that alcohol is now legal in the United States.
So we went through all of that, and here we are again.
I think you really summed it up well, but when we were talking before, when you said there's like a Coen brother-esque streak through this. So now I know that I need the Coen brothers to do my Smokey and the Bandit movie. And I think they'd crush it.
Absolutely. So in this tribunal, point being, prohibition's over. It ends in 1933, December, I think. So, yeah, 90% of the stuff that got us into this case is kind of a moot point at this time. And really, had not someone been killed in this, it probably would have disappeared entirely or gone away very quietly. This next tribunal, owing in great part to the work of famed Coast Guard codebreaker Elizabeth Friedman, the ship was proven to be American-owned and part of an American smuggling syndicate run by a Dan Hogan.
I don't know who Elizabeth Friedman is, but I saw that name in here earlier, and I was really surprised to see a woman that involved with Coast Guard codebreaking at this time.
I was going to include more, but I'd really like to do a bonus episode about her because
Yeah, I was actually thinking the same thing. I'm just very interested in how she was able to do that.
She did stuff in the Second World War, too, with codebreaking.
Interesting.
She wrote a couple books on codebreaking. She's like a pivotal pioneering figure in cryptography. A crypto sis, I guess you could call her. Also, that Dan Hogan, it doesn't appear to be the same dapper Dan Hogan that ran the Irish mob in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was actually killed in a car bombing in December 1928, which is over a year before our story. Like, yes, he still could have been involved in the smuggling ring. And this Dan Hogan is given as being from New York. Not to disparage the Irish, but I think there was probably more than one Dan Hogan who was involved in bootlegging during Prohibition. Canada's damages claim for $268,386.68 was rejected.
I love the specific number.
One of the big things here was the ownership. You know, they're filing for damages, and it's ruled that, okay, this isn't even a Canadian ship. So we're gonna lower that number a little bit. However, since the sinking had been done through excessive and unwarranted force, there was justification for personal compensation of the crew. Leon Main Guy's widow, she received about $10,000.
I'm actually really happy that Mrs. Main Guy got so much money.
Main Girl. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty solid. I mean, granted, you know, losing your husband and all, but $10,000 in what, 1934?
Oh, yeah, 1934.
Captain Randall received $8,000. And each of the crew who'd been aboard or their survivors received $1,000.
I have the inflation calculator pulled up.
How much is $10,000?
Not as much as you might think. A spouse is probably worth more than $230,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you like your spouse, I guess if you don't.
Right. Yeah.
$8,000 is about $183,000. And then the crew members, that's about $23,000. I feel like that's pretty fair. Getting $23,000 just for being there.
For the guys who didn't get hurt, you maybe got roughed up a little bit, probably got cold.
Yeah, I feel like $23,000 can make some of my problems go away.
So the U.S. did ultimately pay Canada $25,000 as a material amend.
Kind of hate that the nation of Canada got the most money in all of this.
Which I guess even for the time, $25,000 seems like it's kind of a pittance. Between nations,
all things considered, right?
Probably more symbolic than anything. And maybe more importantly, the U.S. Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, he actually issued a sort of apology.
Although the commissioners find the mission and use of the vessel at the time of the sinking were unlawful, nevertheless, they also find that its sinking by the United States officers was unlawful. The government of the United States therefore tenders to His Majesty's Canadian government an apology for the sinking of the vessel.
So, I mean, that's about as good of an apology you're going to get out of the United States for anything.
We both said and did some things when we were angry that we didn't mean.
I'm apologizing because they told me I had to. It's an interesting story. We talked about the concept of hot pursuit and how that's been applied other places. One of them that actually would have been before this was Pancho Villa. I mentioned that we would talk about him. You know, Pancho Villa famously raiding into the United States, you know, the Battle of Columbus, and then John Pershing, whose nickname we won't use, followed him back into Mexico, which caused a bit of an incident because we didn't have any sort of permission or invitation from Mexico to do that, which violates one of the tenets of the hot pursuit principle, is that once the pursued enters either their home territory or a third territory, you have to call the pursuit off. And again, famously in Vietnam, you know, with the Viet Cong taking advantage of the kind of porous border situation with Cambodia, similar things where the principle of hot pursuit was sort of considered by some to be a totally viable option, while to others said, well, this is very clearly a violation of international law to cross into another sovereign nation to pursue an enemy without that nation's permission. And then also interesting to note, at the very beginning, we mentioned the Anti-Saloon League. They still exist, kind of.
I am on their website right now, actually.
They have a new name. They're called the American Council on Addiction and Alcohol Problems, the ACAAP. Not to be confused with the NAACP. Very different things. The current issue, I was looking at their site the other day, the current issues menu of their website has sections for alcohol, marijuana, opioids, and gambling. So still finding ways to try to improve society somewhat.
Shame people for their addictions.
Yeah, and they're very tied in with like religious groups and stuff and religious education. But yep, they are still around, still managing to do stuff.
They don't seem super active. I'm just looking at their posts.
No.
I'm looking here. Looks like their last article posted in the alcohol category, if you think that glass of wine is good for you, it's time to reconsider, was posted on January 23rd, 2022. So,
okay.
Been dormant for a minute. And yeah, good. I hope no one donates to them. They sound like losers.
Maybe they've moved their efforts over to TikTok. Knowing the Zoomers, like, I feel like you could definitely get some Zoomers on TikTok involved and really into the modern temperance league.
Judging by this website, and it's like all the 2004 could have offered, they don't know what TikTok is.
But yeah, that's most of the story here. I do like the way that Skoglund's article concludes. I'd like to finish up with a quote from that here.
Ironically, in the 6 years required to thrash out this case, the Prohibition Amendment, without which there probably would have been no such case, was repealed and liquor enforcement treaties rendered dead letters. Most significantly, perhaps, the I'm Alone arbitration represented one more landmark in the friendly relations enjoyed by the United States and Canada, which for over 100 years had enabled them to work out their differences at the conference table rather than on the battlefield.
Yeah, and I think that's cool because, like, yeah, this is a relatively minor case in the grand scheme of things, but it's kind of just another brick in that wall of how neighboring nations handle things with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's an interesting case where, granted, you know, this is post-World War I, you know, as that quote just said, like, U.S. and Canada have a long established relationship here. But the fact that there's never any concept that this could escalate into more shooting just because of the nature of the relationship.
Consider how it's handled versus how a similar incident may have been handled with, like, Mexico. And, like, the willingness to, like, use force, or not even use force, but show force, or the willingness to use force behind it. Yeah, it's very interesting that, like you said, it's just, like, another brick in the wall of, like, a relationship.
Yeah, and, like, at this point, you know, it was, like, a century, and, you know, now from where we are, this is, like, 200 years, basically, more than 200 years, I guess, you know, since the U.S. and Canada were shooting at each other, I guess, unless you count the Fenian invasions of Canada, but which is, I guess, kind of the U.S., but mostly, I guess, blame Ireland for that one.
That was just on Lions Led by Donkeys, I think.
That was a good episode, yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's a story. Got into some fun stuff there. I like when we can just get a little bit of the legal stuff in. I can learn a thing or two. So yeah, that's going to wrap it for this week. We'll be back with something cool for you next week. So take care until then.